Well, hello again, and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets podcast. As you can probably tell, I'm not John Heumann, I'm Mark Robinson. John's away at the moment, well-deserved leave. Actually, I think he's celebrating his birthday, or perhaps commiserating, so all our best wishes go out to John. Ian Smith's away this week as well, and so we've got a bit of a skeleton staff at the IC, but all the people that matter are with me today. I'm joined by Bradley Gerard, our news editor, and our resources writer, Alex Newman. Bradley, I guess we'll kick off with the news as ever. I mean, what's been happening this week?
An interesting thing is the Bank of England obviously recently announced it would be buying up corporate debt as part of its extended quantitative easing programme. It's actually issued now the list of companies whose debt it will purchase. And it's quite interesting, really, because a lot of the companies are really, really big companies. You would kind of almost question why the central bank is buying their debt, really. There are tobacco stocks there, there's power companies, businesses such as Apple even, who really don't need the help in lowering their borrowing costs.
Well, Mark Carney might just be looking to look as if he's doing something, anything really.
True. I just think, I don't know, there was a comment out from Royal London Asset Management this week, and I kind of agree with a point of Jonathan Platt, who's the head of fixed income over there, who said that basically he was disappointed that things like bonds from sectors such as social housing weren't in there, because arguably the point of quantitative easing is to, you know, spread the love throughout the economy, whereas if all you're doing is buying bonds of, you know, incredibly stable companies whose borrowing costs are already low, and some of whom's, you know, contribution to the UK economy is small, why is the bank doing that? So I thought that was quite interesting to see the list.
Well, there's a central point there as well with all of the QE programs, both here and say in America. The actual money supply hardly changed at all, and so, you know, it feeds through into the argument: what did it actually do for the wider economy, other than give a semblance of stability? I'd say
exactly. So there's definitely an argument that really what the bank should be doing is maybe buying slightly riskier bonds that have a higher yield and helping, you know, compress the yields of those types of companies to help those businesses get through. Although then I suppose you'd have the opposite argument of, well, why is it buying such risky debt? But the list is interesting. It is on the Bank of England website. It's quite easy to find. It's worth having a look at. And yeah, I just it's, well, the latest stage in this very long and interesting experiment.
Indeed. And so what else have we got through this week as well? I noticed there was you've written a piece there about Burleywood Capital buying into the football. Well, yeah, not football so much, football gambling.
Football pools, yeah. So it's another kind of, I mean, not necessarily private equity deal, I suppose, which is something we've talked about a lot, more venture capital. There's a company called Sportech, which owns the football pools, which is apparently the world's oldest sort of football gambling business, really. Mm-hmm. And the mooted proposal is that Burleywood Capital will buy the football pools business from Sportech and launch an AIM-listed company within which to house it. So we could see an AIM-listed stock in the market just made up of the football pools business initially, which is quite interesting. I don't know, we were talking about this earlier, the types of floats that are coming to the market. I mean, we've had, you know, this would be a gambling one. We had another one recently. We've had a lot of clothing stocks recently.
Well, we've had Biffa announced today as well.
Biffa today. So the number of IPOs, just kind of sort of scanning my memory the past few weeks, seems to be increasing. And I don't know if there's any sort of correlation about, you know, where markets are and the number of IPOs there are. But
well, I think obviously in this case there must have been some reluctance to come to market prior to the June vote on the referendum, and so there's a bit of a backlog. I mean, we've heard this from various sources as well. But the Biffa one is interesting as well. That's a billion plus valuation given to the. I mean, you can't help but notice them if you travel around London or most places through the UK, actually. But it's interesting, one to watch over the next few months. I might bring in Alex Newman now as well. Alex has been very busy in the magazine as ever this week, and there's a couple of, well, he's contributed a couple of things to the news. One links to Hurricane Energy, which I believe that was one of your tips there, Alex.
Yeah, so when tips go this well, they become news, obviously.
Yes, of course.
So Hurricane Energy was this Shetland's driller, which got financing in April from Crystal Amber and Kerogen and others. Crystal Amber one of the funds that Simon Thompson follows.
Mm-hmm.
And that was to explore the Lancaster field, which they've had a big stake in for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I mean, they've effectively just hit pay dirt. So, I mean, when this happens, you see very, very wild share price swings. In the case of Hurricane Energy, there was a huge leap on the day. I think it's up around 50%. It's done quite well on our tip. So we got in there just before the drilling momentum over the summer started to kick in. So good news for Hurricane. Their results are out in a couple of weeks as well. So I've kept them on a buy, even though the valuation is now looking... is asking quite a lot, I think there could be more good news ahead.
Always the case though with oil stocks that do well, even given prices at the moment, they can be erratic. But you know, you'd be loath to sell out if you've seen examples in the past. But of course, it works the other way too, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Another piece that's a really good piece in the news spotlight this week relates to the collapse of the Hanjin shipping company, a massive South Korean. I think it's about the seventh biggest shipping company in the world. And,
or was, rather.
I believe you looked at some of the wider ramifications here.
Yeah, so Hanjin Shipping Company is a South Korean shipper. They mainly specialise in the containers where 90% of our goods in the high street are shipped via. Some people have called this collapse the Lehman Brothers moment. I think there was a counterparty to Hanjin who described this as a sort of Lehman Brothers moment for the shipping industry. I mean, on the face of it, this is a big, big collapse, and there's, you know, lots of stranded cargo at sea. But
you talk about counterparty risk there. There was about $14 billion worth of goods.
Indeed, yeah. So we've got the likes of Samsung, you know, who used Hanjin with millions and millions of dollars worth of goods set for the, you know, for the Christmas rush. Just floating around somewhere in the Atlantic. But I mean, in terms of the ramifications for the wider industry, it's led to a bit of a spike in rates. I mean, shipping rates are extremely low levels, where basically shipping companies like Hanjin, which is obviously the reason why they collapsed, just can't make any money.
Because massive overcapacity in the industry.
Yeah. And that's all related to, you know, the broader commodities and global economic growth trends that we've seen over the last year. So
trying to sort of reduce the overall global fleet is a bit like trying to turn around a super tanker, if I might use that rather
odd
analogy.
Yeah, I mean it's probably in a way necessary for the shipping industry for there to be these sort of collapses in a sense, because there's so much overcapacity. It's obvious that even though this was a South Korean state bank which was backing Hanjin, they clearly just did not see a future for this company, so highly indebted as it was.
Well, it's one to watch certainly as well. I mean, I know we spoke earlier in the week about this, perhaps looking at the implications for the insurers, but you were saying it's too early to tell at this stage.
Yeah, it's quite intangible, so it's hard to know what the underwriting criteria are and the various premiums. I mean, the Lloyd's, in terms of the Lloyd's listed market, I mean, there is exposure there to shipping and shipping container insurance. I think
I wonder what the crews are doing as well, because presumably they're not getting paid anymore. And if they had a huge sort of shipment of whiskey going out from Scotland or something, I mean, they could just run aground and sell it.
Right, yeah.
Pirates.
Yeah. As I say, it's a really interesting story. And you know, this could have sort of major implications for other industries. But at this stage, we really, really don't know what's going on. No doubt the guys at the Lloyd's will be working over the time to try and find out their level of exposure as well. But I just find it amusing that you would have, you know, that amount of goods. I mean, I wonder what proportion were perishable goods as well.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of it's coming out of South Korea, so these are probably more
manufactured
sort of high-end
items.
Yeah, high-end manufactured items in electronics. So I doubt there's many rotting containers out there.
There was, I read a piece about a documentary maker who was on one of these ships that stranded out at sea, and she was making a documentary called like 22 Days at Sea or something, but it's turned into a lot more than that now.
Oh, wow.
So maybe once her film's finished, we'll have a bit of a better idea of what life was really like for those guys stuck out at sea.
This week's cover feature was co-written by myself and Daniel Liberto, who's decamped to Sicily, but Daniel still writes quite regularly for us. Really, it was a piece that's just looking at some British companies and some sectors that we still hold a major technological advantage. And it's a bit of an antidote to all the naysaying that was leading up to and just after the Brexit vote. When our readers get hold of it, there's a lot of Union Jack livery involved in this. But it was just to really just highlight just how advanced the UK is in some areas of manufacturing still, because I think the myth persists is that we don't actually make anything anymore. But when you I did a little bit of research and looked at the levels of patent applications, which are on the rise, and plus registrations for business. It may be, I make the contention anyway, that it may be this is the point where we've actually finally transitioned away from our traditional industry base, because if you speak to anyone under the age of 40 now, they're fully invested into the idea of a technological value added future for the United Kingdom. So I thought it was high time that we had a look at that.
I mean, patent applications alone, can you take that as a bellwether, do you think?
Well, in isolation, of course, it doesn't mean anything. But I think it just points after a number of years where this was more or less moribund, they're starting to pick up the growth. The trend is an upward trend. Mm. And plus, there's a lot more international patents being filed now from the UK too. And while, you know, compared to South Korea, for instance, the South Koreans, I think, register as maybe three or four times as many patents as we do as well. So there's obviously still room for improvement there. And I concentrated mainly on the defence sector, but also Daniel's having a look at the UK automotive, which we lead in. We didn't even cover pharmaceuticals, but it's just to give a flavour that there are still opportunities here, and the tech market index has done very well over the last few years as well. I also highlighted a company that the IC has been rather keen on for some time, Quadrise Fuels, who are a producer of this MSAR range of fuels, these water-based emulsion fuels that have a number of applications. But it's a classic story as well about how where investors really need patience for this type of technology. It's in its final testing stages now with Maersk, and we could see a rollout of the fuel over the next couple of years. Interestingly, I call it a disruptive technology, but Chris Dillo in his economics piece this week dismisses the notions of disruptive technology. So there you are, differing voices at the IC.
Maersk as well, picking up lots of the customers from Hanjin, just to tie everything we've put in the magazine this week.
Everything
together.
Is tied.
So everything is tied. Their fuels, the Quadrise's fuels, will certainly be put to added use, I imagine.
Fantastic. All right, then I guess we'll just move quickly. I mean, it's the results season, the interim results season is fast approaching its close, although you wouldn't realise that there's another 14 pages of results in the magazine this week, another 14 next week as well. So when will it ever end? Who knows? But Bradley, if I could bring you back in here as well. Anything strike you? I mean, you were looking at Wetherspoons this week, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to personify the reaction of the Leave campaign to the EU referendum, you could just really look at Wetherspoons' share price. Chairman Tim Martin was a very vocal advocate of us exiting the EU, and the shares have just gone on a riotous run ever since the referendum. That's marginally unfortunate for us because we've got them on the sell tip, but...
Well, I think the weather's helped as well. I mean, normally I'm aghast when you read company reports and they blame the weather, but in this case for the pubs, it's been a boon, really.
Absolutely right. I think that's true. I mean, we are still remaining bearish on it because I mean, one reason, the operating margins, they decreased from 7.4% to 6.9%, and while Wetherspoons did increase wages for its staff twice before the national living wage, it's not really entirely clear whether it will need to raise them again to meet the requirements of the new wage that came in earlier this year. And furthermore, the company is buying back a lot of the shares, which is helping. So Tim Martin, the chairman, now owns nearly 30%, is actually going to have to apply to city regulators to avoid having to make a compulsory offer for the group, which is part of UK sort of share ownership law once one shareholder owns 30%.
Mm. Well, I obviously thought, I mean, we've got them on sale at the moment, but they're always interesting stock as well. I mean, I would suspect the question that you raised regarding the national living wage, that's going to have a regional tone to it as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an argument, I suppose, to suggest that it's likely Wetherspoons' estates will be very broadly across the UK, not very concentrated like a rival such as Fuller, Smith & Turner, which is quite London and or inner M25 centric, mm-hmm. Compared to Wetherspoons anyway. So it is a lot more regional, which could have its benefits. But as you say, if we don't get anything moving in the northern powerhouse of the economy and sort of regional areas are not performing quite as well as London, then there could be an issue there, as you say.
Yeah, indeed. Another company that you've covered this week, one that I took an interest in for some time actually, was MP Evans, the palm oil producer.
Yeah, palm oil is an interesting one. A lot of our readers are quite intrigued about the companies that you know, produce palm oil. MP Evans is arguably doubling down on the soft commodity because it's now rid itself of any relationship to Australian cattle and beef herds.
Yeah.
It sold those early this year. So it is purely focusing on palm oil. It's planning on, in the short term, adding roughly 14,000 hectares to its already 35,000. So,
and these are on what might be termed existing agricultural land, brownfield sites.
Yeah, exactly. So that was one thing I kind of raised on the call with management was, you know, I said palm oil has a marginally sort of controversial air about it. And the chief executive kind of hit back and said, well, actually, arguably what the most controversial thing about palm oil is the destruction of rainforest because somebody wants to plant palm oil plants.
Yeah.
And MP Evans, you know, does not go anywhere near primary or well-established secondary rainforest. They have, they said there's plenty and plenty of land in Indonesia, which is obviously comprised of thousands of islands upon which to plant, palm oil crops without destroying rainforest.
Well, the difficulty with it is it has to grow within a narrow tropical band, really. It's one of those type of commodities. Right? But it's taken millions of people out of poverty in Southeast Asia. There's no doubt about that at all. However, it has had a detrimental effect on the environment. You know, subsistence farmers over there will just burn virgin forest in order to clear it.
I think that's the thing. That's the problem about it, and the controversy potentially. But if an established company like this, you know, it would be very clear and obvious, I think, quite quickly if it was destroying rainforest and planting plants. It's absolutely not doing that. So,
and there's the industry body as well, whose name escapes me at the moment. I mean, it's a voluntary code they follow, but I think there is a genuine attempt by the main producers. Wilmar is the largest one in the world, I believe, to make sure that it's within acceptable environmental guidelines.
Yeah, but as you say, I mean, if there are subsistence farmers in particularly Indonesia and Malaysia, the countries together are responsible for between 85 and 87% of global palm oil production, then yeah, there are going to be some farmers out there who are probably going to cut a few trees down they're not supposed to plant some palm oil.
And it's very difficult to avoid as a consumer as well, because it contains everything. Well, it's in foodstuffs and pharmaceuticals in some cases.
It is, yeah. It can be quite difficult to avoid.
Yeah. I think Unilever accounts for 7% of global demand.
That's probably true.
That's it. And Alex, obviously, has been covering the oil companies as they come along, and EnQuest, our old friends there, reported during the week.
Yes, EnQuest, along with Premier Oil, one of the very sort of highly indebted North Sea plays, they, like Premier Oil, are sort of walking this tightrope of debt. And I don't think they're quite at the point that Premier Oil are at in terms of negotiations, but management has flagged that they need to raise additional liquidity. I mean, when I wrote this result early this week, the greatest potential source of that liquidity would be a Delek Group taking a stake in the Kraken exploration, Kraken project, which is going to come on stream next year.
Yeah,
and so there was talk of a 20% stake in that, which could raise sort of towards $200 million. That's fallen through as of today. So EnQuest shareholders and retail bondholders, probably a point at which to look at the shares again, make that call. There will quite possibly have to do some sort of a farm out deal soon. But Finally balanced.
Do you remember at the top of your head what the impact of the Kraken will be when it comes online? I mean, will dramatically alter EnQuest cash flows then?
Kraken coming online will increase from sort of mid 2017. Will greatly increase the number of barrels. They've also got the long awaited production from the Scolty and Craithes wells, mm-hmm. and drilling earlier this year from the Alma and Gala wells also added quite a significant amount to daily production. But I mean, it's still, you know, with the oil price where it is, it's still a bit of a tightrope, particularly when they've got $1.8 billion of non-current debts on their balance sheet. So having to address these longer term events in tandem is going to be a very, very testing.
Is there any chance of them coming back to the market, or?
I don't think that's been signalled as of yet, but I mean, we can sort of never rule these things out. You'd imagine that they would have other sources of financing if people were going to start to get bullish on the oil price en masse.
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? And even so, I think shareholders have invested enough time and capital in it so far. So I would think with all this new production coming into view that they would probably find backing anyway. But then again, they'd probably be able to get primary finance eventually, yeah. I would imagine. Okay, well, I think that's about it for this week. Next week, chances are we'll have both John and Ian back for the podcast. But until then, thanks very much and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.